everyone, to Season 2 of IDEA, the podcast about improving data engagement and advocacy. To our old listeners, welcome back. To our new listeners, we're glad that you can join us. We are your hosts, Brianna Wham, Data Learning Center Manager and Research Data Management Librarian at Penn State University.
And Shannon Sheridan, Research Data Librarian at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. And we're so excited to be back with all of you. So in case you're new to the show, here's how it works. Each episode, we alternate between an interview with a data practitioner to talk about interesting projects or engagement activities they're working on. Alternating months, Brianna and I do an article review, keeping you up to date on the literature that's being published that you could find useful in your work.
We're kicking off this season of IDEA with an interview from a group that's doing some really cool, really big data management work and engagement around an open data source. Research in general is increasingly requiring working with both large amounts of data as well as a diversity of data types.
Additionally, data reuse is being highly encouraged as a means to build on previous research and to enable answering larger and more complex problems through combining data sources. However, data reuse is challenging when the data aren't easily understandable. So the question is, how can data producers make their data more openly available and reusable? And of particular interest to this podcast, how can generating data and providing open access to it be an engagement opportunity?
Today, we're going to be talking with folks from the National Science Foundation-funded Ocean Observatories Initiative, or OOI. OOI is an exceptional example of a project that makes immense amounts of data openly available in understandable ways and offers engagement around these data to further reuse potential. OOI itself is a major facility that maintains more than 900 instruments to collect and deliver real-time data related to the world's oceans.
And that data is freely available online to anyone with an internet connection. And so we're super excited to get to chat today with Jim Edson, Jeff Gladstein, and Craig Rizian from OOI to learn more about how they've been able to accomplish this feat and what approaches could be applied to similar open data and data reuse efforts. Welcome to the show, everybody. We're super excited to have you here with us today.
So can you introduce yourself and briefly describe what role you play in the research data ecosystem at your institution or organization?
So I'm Jim Edson. I'm a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic. You'll hear us call that HOOE, and in the engineering department. But for the purposes of this podcast, more importantly, I'm the lead PI of the Ocean Observatories Initiative. The project management office is here at Woods Hole, and so I'm the lead PI on that. And I, full disclosure, I am a marine meteorologist running an oceanographic research institution. So, but people put up with me nonetheless.
Jeff Gladstein, I'm the senior manager of cyber infrastructure. I also am at HOOE, and my role is overall oversight of the cyber infrastructure and data delivery. And my background is that of a developer.
And I'm Craig Rizian. I'm at Oregon State University. I'm the project manager for the data center that's housed, the OOI data center that's housed here at OSU. And my background's in oceanography. So I also do a little bit of research here at OSU with some of the faculty research that's involved with some NOAA projects too.
Awesome. Thank you. And so now, can you tell us, what is the Ocean Observatories Initiative?
I think of the OOI as a group of scientists here that are running a system of systems or system of ocean observatories. And I like to think of us as we deploy sophisticated sensors in difficult places, like the North Atlantic, which we just came back from, and other locations. And so I think that's pretty much it. I mean, the idea is that we go to these locations, we collect a high quality data set as we can, and then we provide these to researchers, educators, students, and the general public. And very importantly, and you'll hear this throughout, is it's free of charge. So anyone can access this data with a link.
Certainly all the platforms, instruments, everything else that we've got out in the ocean. And then we have this cyber infrastructure that networks it all together. And so when you have a glider or a camera sitting on the seafloor or a profiler going up and down, those are able to telemeter their data to shore through Iridium networks, through fiber optic cables. So those data are able to come to shore and they all end up at OSU in the data center where they're stored and processed. We perform a bunch of quality control on the data and then we make it available to the public, as Jim said.
Coming at it from the data side, to me, it's a large collection of data. Anything from, and I know sometimes a dirty word, a data lake to a data lake house, but really it is just a massive store of data.
When did it all get started?
These guys have just as much information about that specifically, but OOI. But I'll say that I started working on this project at the turn of the century, literally. And so at around 2000, I was in the midst of building a cabled observatory off the coast of Martha's Vineyard in the North Atlantic. And that caught the attention of sort of an oceanographic visionary, John Delaney, who envisioned having a cabled array that covered the Juan de Fuca plate, which is off the Oregon Washington coast, so that he was able to investigate things like hydrothermal vents. And we even have a active volcano now on that platform. And so through a lot of meetings and workshops and white papers, we convinced the NSF, the fancy term, we got support under the Major Research Equipment and Facilities Construction Account, which is basically the types of accounts that they use to build the Hubble telescope. And so this is one of the biggest things that's happened in terms of oceanography in that program, I think probably to date, I would say. And so I think we got that funding in like 2011. And there's some debate about when it was officially done, but let's say somewhere between 2014 and 2016. And then we took over the program, Woods Hole, with help from OSU and the University of Washington in 2018. That kind of, and so I'll stop there.
I'm the newbie. My tenure started 5 years ago when the PMO came to Woods Hole. So I don't have any great stories about how it started, but I know we've been collecting data now for 7 years.
Well, hopefully you've got a long future ahead of you in collecting data as well.
I hope so.
So it sounds like from this initiative, it's been both longitudinal, you have a lot of time and a lot of sensors, and you're collecting a lot of data. And so what does the process of making that data available look like? What have been some of the challenges or things that you've had to work through to make that openly available to the public?
That's a huge question. Having given this some thought, I've broken out to about three stages. We have a pretty extended data life cycle. But if you break it out, we have the delivery of the data from the instrument, ingestion into our databases so that it's ready, and then consumption by the user. A lot goes into delivery, and Craig may be better place to talk about this. But that's where the instruments are put together, the data product algorithms are put together, there's QA, QC that goes into that process. And then the data is delivered in few different ways. You've heard us talk about cabled. It can be telemetered. It can be sent over by cell. It can also be physically recovered off of the instrument. The instruments store their data on the system. And then that's delivered to the shore stations, which are run by the individual marine implementing organizations, UW, Oregon State, Woods Hole. Then it gets sent to central cyber infrastructure. And that's where most of the automation kicks in. We read it off a queue and we do what's called an ingestion process. And that process is has a lot of parsers in it. Each instrument's data comes off a little bit differently, proprietary format. And so we ingest it using those algorithms into the database and try to normalize the data, temperature, salinity, so on and so forth. And that's where the ingestion stops. And then there's lots of ways to get the data out. And quite a bit happens during that. While you're getting the data out, it runs QA/QC tests. It applies calibrations. You can get them out, get the data out through two front ends, a legacy one that a lot of people have been with us for a while like. Another one, Data Explorer, where it processes the data ahead of time. So when a user comes in, they can see all the temperature variables plotted across all of our arrays. If they want to do that comparison, right? They can look at one single array, one water column, what have you there. You also can get to the data through a machine-to-machine interface, an API, basically. And that way, if you're going after the same data on a regular basis, maybe to fill some application that you're doing, you can schedule it, just run it, and you don't have to keep going through a front end for that. You can also get the data directly from the instrument. We store all the raw data, and that's on a simple Apache share. And then what we're really excited about is we just launched a Jupyter Hub. It allows the users to process the data in place. So you no longer have to download it. And so for data, which not all data is calculated, we also have a fair amount of video. We have sound data, bio data. That's pretty large to download. You could process that in place. And it also alleviates the users from having some pretty big systems. And one could argue no laptop's big enough to process some of our data. So you get to take advantage of our systems, our memory, and our cores. That really does kind of do what I like to call data democratization, where anybody can get, as Jim said, anybody with an internet link can get to the data.
That's a lot of data. I feel like this is going to be a really great thing that hopefully others in various fields that could do similar things can adopt similar approaches, because I think it's really phenomenal what you all have been able to do, and that you're able to make that data accessible, especially to folks maybe that won't, like you said, have the equipment to process it otherwise.
There's a lot of data. We have 1.5 petabytes of raw data and then a bunch of other stuff that we store.
It's about volume and performance. Data is coming in 24/7. It never stops unless there's a problem with the instrument, which of course we don't want. And so it's that constantly moving the goalpost with performance and user experience, because, you know, when we only had 2 years worth of data, getting it out, if you think about it, it's pretty straightforward. 4 years, 5 years, 7 years, starts to get difficult. Right now we have 130 billion rows. Where will we be 5 years from now? And you constantly have to keep that in mind and figure out how to manage that and move the performance forward.
Yeah, from somebody who manages the data center, that's certainly something I think about a lot, because it's not only storing these data. NSF spent hundreds of millions of dollars on this project, allowing us to collect these data. They're incredibly valuable. I want to make sure that they're stored and safe and secure. And we take that responsibility very, very seriously. But also, you've got to protect these data. And so you have to start having copies of them all over the place, whether it's on tape or some other storage cluster on the East Coast, or we've got a partnership now with TAC down in Texas. So we're copying data down there. And as this volume of data grows, it becomes more challenging just from a data management standpoint to figure out how to store these data securely, how to protect them, how to make them available to the end user community. But just to give you kind of an idea of how difficult it is to move this stuff around, you know, it's hard to download 600 terabytes, obviously, to your hard drive. But when we were taking on this project, so the data center, we started in 2020, in October 2020. It was being run by Rutgers University at the time, and we had to get all the raw data from Rutgers University to OSU. And it was much faster to copy it onto a NAS, a network attack storage device, and ship it. So we had a rack, and we just copied data to these drives, and we literally shipped this rack to OSU, copied the data, half of it off onto our new system, shipped the rack back, copied the data, shipped it. So that was a faster way to move this stuff around than trying to get it copied over the internet. It's a lot of data. And so there's, you know, in looking at this question, I was like, well, that was a process. It took us many, many months to physically move the data across the country.
And I would have to imagine that doing some of the curating is similarly, I don't want to call it onerous, but I know like big data sets is a discussion that comes up a lot with our researchers, because some of the data that's coming off our machines, it is also terabytes of data. And how do you even approach curating that amount of data?
I think one instrument at a time. Altogether as a data set, it's massive. But if you break it out by, hey, I want to understand, I don't know, a particular water column and these instruments are involved, or I want to understand maybe some biological metrics in the ocean, yeah, then maybe you would use hydrophone and video. So I think you're not tackling it all at once, and that's the key. So, you know, some of our data lifecycle is about annotating the data, human in the loop analysis of it, as well as coming up with quality tests. And the way we do that is instrument by instrument.
That makes sense. That's a good philosophy, instrument by instrument. So then once you go through, you know, you get the data, it's gone through its life cycle. What do you all see as the benefit of making all of this data available openly for society in general, but also specifically the data users that end up reusing it?
But, you know, Jeff used the term that we like to use, which is democratization of the data. It's really, you know, because anyone can access this with an Ethernet connection or internet connection, it really allows people, you can be on Cape Cod, you know, we love our ocean, but you can also be in Iowa, you can be in Panama. It really doesn't matter. And it just is bringing the ocean to these locations, and we're seeing it. I mean, we look at sort of the, you know, geographical distribution of where our students are coming from, or where students going to the oceanographic institutions are coming from. And it's becoming broader and broader. We are seeing people literally from, you know, Iowa coming, and normally they'll do their graduate research at one of these coastal oceanographic institutions, but, you know, not always. And so it's really terrific to see that happening. So that's one thing that I noticed just as a lead scientist here, that it's, I love the fact that anyone can have access to the data, and that's happening more and more and more.
I think there's a huge interest, obviously, in climate change, and the ocean, a small part of our planet, is covered in them. So I think that definitely drives a lot of interest out there in having this data. And I think one of the unique parts of the program, and probably Jim and Craig can talk to this, is that we're taking measurements in a single place for an extended period of time to get that longitudinal data out there. So now you can start to look at trends. And, you know, imagine if we had this data going back 100 years. It might make the, you know, the analysis of climate or ocean change easier if you had all that. So I think that's something that the program definitely brings to the forefront.
This represents a real fundamental shift from when I was starting out in oceanography. Everything was done from cruises on ships. And so you'd go out for 3 to 6 weeks, you'd have a hypothesis you hoped to test. Sometimes you nailed it, often you didn't, and you made do with what data you collected. This is completely different. If you wait long enough, you're going to see all sorts of phenomena that you're interested in, right? So it really is a fundamental shift. And for some of the older oceanographers, it's a little tough. The people that I see really making use of this data and this approach are young people, early career scientists, students. And, you know, through that, they're getting some of us older folks, you know, interested in this approach. I've always been interested in this approach, but that's kind of what I see. And I think that's what I find really exciting about this approach.
Yeah. Oceanography is very expensive. It's also, you know, and so when you're a young scientist coming in, you don't have a big lab with lots of money coming in, it can be hard to get out and start making these sorts of measurements. And always is out there doing it for them and then sharing those data with them so that they can do their research. And then on the training side, yeah, making these data available, making them available through interfaces like JupyterHub, where students can come in, they can learn to program in Python or in R, they can use these data for learning data analysis techniques. I think that's also a great benefit to the research community, society at large.
Yeah, can you expand a bit on that kind of training aspect and then maybe any other aspects? In this podcast, we really like to talk about kind of engagement and how can we engage more folks with using data, sharing data, and that process. And so how to you does making this data available, how is that an engagement opportunity?
I'll address that first. I'm sure the other guys have some thoughts on this. One of the things that we are going to implement this year with the new 5-year program is what we're calling the Data Ambassador Program. And so this would be a team. It would be a scientist that could go to any number of places, right? And we're actually talking with our DEI officer about places where we could go to spread the word. And so the scientists would give a talk on a topic of interest for that particular location. And then a data specialist would be along to run, say, a mini workshop on how to access the data. The smaller groups, we're really trying to formalize that within the program over the next 5 years. We're calling it SUGR, which is a clever acronym, Scientific User Group for Research Meetings. And it's to bring in small groups like this together to talk about specific instruments, for example, could be one of these meetings, making the most out of these difficult to maintain instruments, like a bioacoustic sensors are tricky, for example. And we've just had, various workshops on that.
Those are some really awesome examples. And I love how much you guys are focused on that hands-on working with the researchers so they can get the most out of your data. And I'm kind of curious just in terms of how you get that audience, because you guys are fairly unique in that you, I would imagine, don't have a large permanent constituency in terms of, researchers that work for OOI. It sounds like most of your data users are coming from other institutions. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I'll make a very clear point. We are not funded to do research. The OOI is not. We are funded to provide the highest quality data we can to the research community. Okay. Yes. So, in fact, all of the people that are, publications are our currency. That's one thing. And so if you look at our publication list, the vast majority of them are coming from outside those three institutions. Mm-hmm. We're three of the biggest oceanographic institutions in the country. So we do write a lot of papers using the data, mm-hmm. but that's on separate grants. It's not on OOI.
With that sort of model, what does your outreach look like? Or do you find that you have more people coming to you than you know what to do with? Do you have to do a lot of outreach to let people know the quality of the data that you can provide? What does that look like?
The thing with outreach is most of our money is for operation and maintenance of the arrays. But all of us go above and beyond, I have to say, for outreach, to get out and getting out to community colleges, getting out to, our peer institutions as well. For example, I wanted to go to University of Washington, not their oceanography department, but their atmospheric sciences department, and make them aware of this amazing data set they can take advantage of out over the ocean. And that's where that data ambassador program comes in. That's where, trying really hard to take advantage of opportunities like at the Ocean Sciences meeting that's coming up that the AGU sponsors. We try to get into as many sessions as we can, showing off the data that we've collected. So it's a lot of hard work, and it's a labor of love for a lot of us, because like I said, we do this almost in our spare time, all the outreach efforts, but we do it. And so I think it's really important.
I think there's a lot of legwork from the PIs building this community, one meeting at a time, one interaction at a time. I think that's really been successful, and we're certainly hoping to grow that with the Data Ambassador Program.
Yeah, you have a very impressive array of engagement opportunities that you all have taken on. It's really interesting going from user testing of your actual platform, it sounds like, to training opportunities, these summer camps, this ambassador program. And it sounds like a lot of that is making it where both folks are aware of it, are using the data. And you touched on something there that I'm intrigued by, because I know that's working with a data repository here at Penn State, one of the things that researchers sometimes are concerned about is if folks are reusing it, do I know they're understanding the data and reusing it correctly or appropriately? Is that something that you all talk about with many of these kind of future reusers, or have any kind of concern about, or is it that there's good standards within the field that people are aware of?
There are naming conventions and standards that we apply, I think, and I'm probably not the right one to answer this question, but it strikes me when speaking with users, they tend to talk to each other a lot. And I think through that support, they tend to understand the data. And certainly I don't know that any of them work just by themselves. For the most part, I've seen teams overall. So I think that's helpful.
And so for our last question, how do you hope to see the OOI project develop in the future?
I'd love to see a library of examples out there, as well as a method for curated data sets, combining the two so that we can make it a little bit easier and improve user experience. I'd also like to see us start looking at machine learning and simple AI, not what we've seen in the news, in terms of looking at data quality and maybe even help desk functionality. You know, we've talked about how there are different ways to get data out of the system. Wouldn't it be nice if someone could talk to a little bit of a chat bot and say, where's the best place to get this X data? Are there any examples out there? And try to do that. And that's a much of a far future type of thought.
So I'm really jazzed about what Craig and company are doing at OSU, because our claim is, and it's true, but it's, we want to convince the communities that we can make these measurements from seafloor to sea surface to lower atmosphere, all of them for people to use. And wouldn't it be nice if they didn't have to go through all the time and effort to get all those pieces together to provide, a velocity profile, a temperature profile, salinity profile, along with all the other more complicated systems. And so that's one thing that, and I just love the idea that having a toolbox where we can, put those sorts of, time series of from seabed to sea surface temperatures or salinities. I'm really also excited about, we are getting these more sophisticated sensors so that they operate for, some things we have no control over, like biofouling, which is why we turn things in coastal areas every 6 months and in global areas every year. Because in the coastal areas, they get gunked up and there's only so many ways you can keep them clean, but we're doing better and better and better at that. And that means, I think there's most biogeochemists are really excited when they have a 4 month high quality complete data set, and then it kind of goes, well, we're working hard to make that, 8 months, and then ultimately the entire year. And that's a goal that we have. We'd really like to be able to do that. So there's so many things I look forward to working on in the next 5 years, but those are just a couple for me.
Yeah. I mean, at a very basic level, the developing into the future, one could say just maintaining this equipment and extending these time series. These are rare time series. I mean, if you look at oceanographic time series, they, as Jim was saying much earlier, the old campaign style where you'd go out and you'd collect a week's worth of data or a mooring over a summer or something. These are long time series now that extend years and years and years, and we hope for 20, 30 years. That makes them really valuable, really unique. And so just developing those time series, building on those time series out into the future is going to be a huge success. And obviously the engagement and building the user community, having people write more proposals, use these data, use them in different ways, whether it's artificial intelligence or the modeling community or in a teaching setting, whatever it is. It's going to be really exciting, I think, to start to see that develop, because historically, we had shorter time series and we were struggling with some biofouling issues, and we're working hard to, and we have overcome a lot of that struggles with delivering data. And we've, I think, overcome that with the Data Explorer system that was developed. I think we're in a really good space now. We have these starting to develop really long time series and robust mechanisms to deliver these data. And so our best years are ahead of us. And I'm really excited to see how this all plays out.
Sounds like there's a bright future ahead, and you guys have some big plans to build on the impressive work that you're already doing.
That's something I was just going to say. I've been really impressed listening to all of you. And I know I mentioned this briefly in one of the snippets, but I really do feel like what you all have done is going to be an amazing model for how things should be set up in the future from both like a data management perspective, research data, and open data sharing in general.
Yeah, you can even learn what not to do from us as well. sometimes you hope with the best of intentions, but sometimes it doesn't work.
You learn from your mistakes though, right?
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeff, Craig, and Jim for coming on to talk to us and to talk to our listeners about the OOI and all of the work you're doing with data curation, production, and researcher engagement around it. It was great getting to hear three distinct views and parts of the process, and yet hear kind of this complete story about all of the work that you're doing.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks for joining us, folks. We hope you enjoyed this episode of IDEA.
You can find the resources from today's show in the show notes.
Our theme music is by Scott Holmes. And a big thanks to the Research Data Alliance Interest Group, Engaging Researchers with Data, for supporting our work.
If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to rate or review us wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next time.